This is live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lindsay Clancy from the Hitting Tillers podcast in True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
On page 4 of your report, where you...
Hold on 1 second. Okay, I'm sorry, counsel.
On page 4 of your report, where you list the sources of information, you do identify as number 24, forensic psychiatric evaluation of Philip J. Resnick from 9/27/24, do you not?
I do.
And so that's something you reviewed.
I didn't draw my opinion.
That wasn't a question, sir.
Hold on. You asked the question again. Go ahead.
Did you review his report?
That's not the question.
Question, sir, is did you review Dr. Resnick's report prior to authoring your report or coming to your conclusions about diagnosis?
I reviewed part of that report. And in my report, I perused through the reports. I did not review all of that report from Dr. Resnick or Dr. Spinelli, for that matter.
Okay. Now, in talking about your review of records, you indicated that there are several thousand pages of Tewksbury Hospital records, correct?
7,000 and one page.
And did you review all of those?
I would say I looked through them, but I did not read every word on every page. They do have a tendency to hang together and are replicative as well.
Were you aware that on May 26, 2023, that the defendant was observed by staff in a note stating that she was visible along the unit hallways, self-propelling her wheelchair with her one-to-one staff, that she had a visit with her mother who brought dinner for her, they ate and played games during the visit? Are you aware of that?
On May 26th
of 2023.
So 3 years ago and a few months, I don't know that. I don't remember.
That would have been approximately 4 months after the incident and on the date of Callan's first birthday, right?
Yes, but you asked if I remember that event, and I don't.
You don't, or you do?
I don't remember that she was seen with her mother on that day who brought food, and she was seen using a wheelchair to travel down the hallway at the hospital. I don't remember.
If I tell you that was read from page 176 of the Tewksbury Hospital records, would you agree with that?
I would not doubt that.
Okay. And on December 24th of 2023, were you aware that the defendant was observed at Tewksbury, monitored on one-to-one for safety, that she accepted medication, meals, and snacks. She spent time in the TV room or sitting outside her room, utilizing phone, and visited with family. Do you recall that, reading that note on page 613 of the Tewksbury records?
Of 2023?
Yes.
Honestly, I don't.
And that would have been Cora's birthday.
Okay.
But would you agree with me that if I read that from page 613 in the records, that that would be within that 7,001 page that of the record?
I would not doubt that.
How about on January 24th, 2024, where she's observed in a note from Tewksbury State Hospital on page 674 saying, where the note reads, patient was visible in the milieu, engageable with both staff and select peers. Patient accepted select medications as her baseline, that she was pleasant during interactions, self-propelling in wheelchair in the halls, spending much of the morning and early afternoon in her room and hall on her electronics. Do you recall reading that record?
Not specifically.
And January 24th, 2024 would have been the year anniversary of the incident, correct?
Yes.
But if I read from page 674, you would agree with me that that's part of the Tewksbury record?
Yes, I believe it's part of the record.
And on May 26th of 2024, from page 922 of the Tewksbury record, patient monitored one-to-one for safety. She's been monitored for high suicide risks, accepted medication, says BFK and snacks. She spent some time in the TV room or sitting outside her room utilizing phone. Would you agree that that's a fair reading of page 922?
I have no reason to doubt that.
Okay. And that she's also observed on that same day, visible on the unit while utilizing her phone outside her room, was able to make her needs known appropriately. Patient was observed playing dominoes with peers in the TV room. That was later in the day on May 26, 2024, which would have been Callan's second birthday.
I would believe that that record's probably accurate. I don't remember looking at that record specifically.
How about on September 30th of 2024, page 1,229 of the Tewksbury record, where it's noted that she was visible in the unit, attended startup / coffee group, assisted with AD, or she was assisted with ADLs as needed. She was in safe behavioral control for the duration of the shift. And that later it reads, patient visible in the hallways, seated in her wheelchair outside her bedroom, using her cell phone, pleasant upon approach, social with select peers. That would have been on September 30th, 2024, which would have been Dawson's fifth birthday. Do you recall reviewing that in the record?
Not off the top of my head, but I have no reason to doubt that's not an accurate record.
December 24th, 2024, page 1,442 of the Tewksbury records. Says the patient was visible on the unit utilizing her phone. Her parents were in to visit and they brought dinner with them. Patient accepted medications and fluids. Patient in good behavioral control, maintaining safety. No SIB noted or reported. What do you have reason to doubt that that's on page 1,442 of the Tewksbury record?
I have no reason to doubt that that's not an accurate reflection of what took place that day.
And what's SIB?
Self-injurious behavior.
And so December 24th, 2024, that would have been Cora's seventh birthday, right?
Yes.
So January 24th, 2025, from page 1,514 of the Tewksbury records, where it reads, inpatient treatment goal, to work on my mental health and to feel better. It says, she participated in morning ADL routine with staff assistance. Patient was visible on the milieu at times in the hallway utilizing her phone. No SIB has been reported this shift. Does that, do you have any reason to doubt that that's contained on page 1,514?
I have no reason to doubt that.
And that further observations on that day were that the patient was visible on the unit. She was social with select staff and peers and also seen utilizing her phone. Her parents were in to visit and brought her dinner, and they brought dinner with them. That was, again, on January 24th, 2025, which would have been the second anniversary of this incident, correct?
Yes.
May 26th, 2025. Page 1,782 of the Tewksbury records. It says, she did not engage in any SIB. She was visited by her parents this shift. She attended startup group and watched TV. That would have been on May 26, 2025, which would have been Callan's third birthday. Do you have any reason to doubt that in the record?
I have no reason to doubt that.
And on September 30th, 2025, of the Tewksbury record on page 2056, reads, patient was visible in the hallway using her phone. No SIB or behavioral issues observed or reported. Do you have any doubt? Do you have reason to doubt that that is an accurate read of page 2056?
I have no reason to doubt that that's not accurate.
And that would have been September 30th, which would have been Dawson's sixth birthday, right?
Yes.
and on December 24th of 2025, page 76 of the patient notes in the Tewksbury Hospital records, it reads, ate breakfast, refused lunch, took snacks, utilizing phone, assisted with ADLs, spent some time in the TV room, attended PT, resting in bed after lunch. Do you have any reason to doubt that is contained within the Tewksbury records on page 76?
No.
And December 24th would have been Cor's 8th birthday, correct?
Yes.
And on page 152 of the Tewksbury records, January 24th, 2026, this year. Patient observed for safety, assess mental status, encourage safe behavioral control, monitoring for abrupt behavior change in an attempt to prevent escalation or self-harm, encourage patient to participate in groups, but that in, on this particular day, she was also observed compliant with meds, ate breakfast, participated in coffee group, visible in the hallway utilizing her phone, later visited with parents, and had an early lunch. That was on January 24th of 2026. Do you have any reason to doubt that's within the records?
No.
And that she was later observed to not have any SIB or behavioral issues, again on January 24th, 2026. Do you have any reason to doubt that's contained within the Tewksbury records?
No. No.
And again, you reviewed or looked at some of them, but not every one of these. But these are already currently in evidence, correct?
Yes.
Your Honor, I would move to admit these excerpts as the next exhibit, please.
Any objection?
No problem.
All right, that may be admitted. Okay, thank you.
And Dr. Zeisel, as far as the records that I just read in, do you know if in those records it indicates that she slept well on all of those occasions?
I wouldn't know. I don't know how.
But you would agree that noting her sleeping habits based on this particular individual's history would be an important thing for the hospital to monitor, correct?
I would agree with that.
Now, in this particular case, well, let me ask you, are you familiar with the concept of confirmation bias?
Of course.
And fair to say, it's pretty prevalent in most areas of science and forensic psychology and psychiatry, correct?
It crosses all domains of work and life.
And as far as confirmation bias for psychiatry or providers, fair to say that clinicians are warned that they may lean towards or support their own theories and overlook contradictory evidence, and that you have to be aware of that, correct?
Yes.
And again, in forensic psychology, the goal is to render an objective opinion, right?
Yes. The facts come to you. You don't go to the facts.
Okay. And there's a danger for clinicians and forensic psychologists of quickly forming an initial diagnosis before having all the information, correct?
Yes.
And that confirmation bias accounts for the fact that a lot of times people, clinicians and providers, will cling to diagnoses and interpret subsequent information in light of that kind of already perceived idea. Is that fair to say?
They cling, I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. They cling to a diagnosis?
Well, once a diagnosis is reached, they cling to that diagnosis when interpreting subsequent information.
That happens, yes.
And but you would agree that in practice of forensic psychology that it's important not to do that, right?
Particularly with the guidelines of criminal responsibility where you don't need a diagnosis, just need a mental disease or defect.
But diagnoses are helpful in understanding whether the person was suffering from this legal construct of a mental disease or defect, correct?
That's fair to say.
And it's fairly accepted in the field that if somebody has a disorder or a diagnosed mental illness, that they then in turn suffer from a mental disease or defect. Or could.
Or could, because you can have a phobia. Doesn't mean you have a mental disease or defect. If you're afraid to jump out of airplanes, it doesn't make you ineffective and have a defect or a disease. So, yes, it could.
Yeah, you keep your voice up.
Yes, Ron. Okay. So it could, but it doesn't always have to.
Thank you.
Of course.
And you're aware of the danger of this idea of confirmation bias of having multiple relationships and conflicts in this type of work, correct?
Yes.
And that's why it's important not to be treating somebody as a patient when you're also evaluating them for this type of legal issue, right?
Of course. You cannot be the therapist and the examiner. The therapist is an advocate. The examiner looks for the truth.
And do you recall in this case submitting recommendations to the court in November of 2025 about the defendant regarding accommodations for her?
I know in general, but I don't know specifically what those accommodations requests were. I can't remember them.
But you wrote, you authored and signed a letter dated November 13, 2025 to the court, correct?
Yes, but I'm saying I don't remember specifically what those recommendations were. I know I did that.
I'm not asking you that. I'm just asking if you wrote the letter.
Okay. Hold on. Just ask me a question. Doctor, go ahead. If you listen to the question.
Yes, sir.
I'm asking if you wrote the letter, sir.
Yes.
And in that letter, you refer to providing essential clinical findings regarding the transportation of my patient, Lindsay Clancy. Do you recall writing that?
Yes.
And so at various points throughout over the years of this case, you have referred to it as your patient, have you not?
I wouldn't be, I think, able to define her as something else. She was a patient who I did a forensic evaluation of.
Well, you referred to the court outside of this evaluation you're testifying about to her as your patient in this letter from November 13th of 2025.
Right. I evaluated Ms. Clancy, who is a patient. If I evaluated her, then she's my patient, as she is other doctors' patients at Tewksbury and other places that she's been at.
But you call her my patient in the letter.
I wrote the letter. Whose patient would I be referring to if I'm speaking about Ms. Clancy, given that she's my patient? Yes, I wrote she was my patient. That's correct. Okay.
And you're aware of, again, the APA guidelines on forensic psychology, where it warns therapeutic forensic role conflicts. Providing forensic and therapeutic psychological services to the same individual involves multiple relationships that may impair objectivity and or cause exploitation or other harm. You're aware of that, Section 4.02?
Yes.
And in this particular case, since the beginning, you've appeared regularly in court hearings, right?
Yes.
You've appeared with Attorney Reddington at arraignment proceedings.
At his request, yes.
Both here and at Tewksbury State Hospital, where you were sitting next to the defendant?
Yes.
And you also, on February 8th of 2023, participated in a news conference, did you not?
Yes.
It was outside the courthouse here.
Yes.
And you gave an interview with the Daily News where you commented on this.
I just made a comment. That's correct.
And at this time, Your Honor, I'd like to play a clip of the news conference, please.
Mr. Reddington?
Why not?
Hi.
Right.
can't see the TV.
Thanks. I've been past few days, multiple hours each day. What I can say without going too far is that her affect is absolutely flattened. She's in a very surreal state. It feels dreamlike to her, as she's described to me on multiple occasions. And individuals who can present as being lucid, linear, and clear thinking do not make those people not mentally ill. They have the capacity for, on occasion, to be able to do things that they've been doing for a long period of time. When you have delusional thinking, fixed beliefs that are unchangeable, and hallucinations, namely command hallucinations, telling you to do things that are malevolent, and you believe those voices that some of you need to control what they say, that's when things go downhill. Behaviorally, psychiatrically, and familially. And that's what we see in the most tragic of cases, where individuals could be healthy and normal, and quite frankly, because they're paranoid and worried about what others think, they hold back on what they fear. And in some cases throughout the country and the world, these are people who one day will be functioning well, but because they have the onset of command hallucinations, which they fear to, leave the voice that they have to do something, that's when tragedy occurs. And I think that sort of is under the override that this case falls under.
So, sir, on December 8th of 2023, when you provided that your observations, you had met with the defendant on two occasions, correct?
I believe three occasions.
Okay. Had you any of the records that have been presented in the course of this trial?
No.
Any of the records that are listed in your sources of information?
No.
And as you sit here and testify today, you've testified to the same conclusions, correct?
What I said was individuals like that present this way. I was not referring to Ms. Clancy. I said individuals who have these symptoms, like the ones I clarified, present that way. That was not an assessment of Ms. Clancy. That was an assessment of people who go through major mental health crises.
But as you sat here today, you've talked about the fact that she had delusional thinking, the fact that she had command hallucinations, the fact that she believed that these voices and that she was paranoid and worried, you've consistently testified about that throughout the course of yesterday and today, correct?
So
it's a yes or no.
You make it impossible to answer that question.
All right, the next question.
In addition to, you testified today that a person in a psychotic state can do things they've done before, but it might be hard for them to do new tasks, right?
Yes.
So if it's something that is part of their daily life, getting up, caring for the kids, feeding, making a meal, driving a car, those are things that people do every day and a lot of times don't even have to think about, right?
Yes. No thinking necessary.
But your
response, automatic response.
You're aware that on this particular day of this incident, on January 24th of 2023, that the defendant took Cora to the doctors, right?
Yes.
And you indicated in your testimony today that it was for a regular checkup, but in your report, you identify that it was for a stomach ache, right?
Yes. She had a stomach ache.
But in addition to maybe her having a stomach ache, she had previously had this visit scheduled, and you're aware of that now, correct?
Yes.
And at the doctor, there was a recommendation made for an over-the-counter medication, right?
Yes.
And the defendant was able to process that information, take it back with her, and then later, not immediately after the visit, but later in the day, search for where to get that medication, right?
Psychosis doesn't lower your intellectual functioning, so you can do all those things. So
well, that correct. Wasn't my question. My question was, did she do those things?
Yes, so that's correct.
Okay. And would you, you've talked a lot about that a person can operate as normally as they can, but fair to say, if you're in a psychotic state, that person themselves has a significant amount of distress, right?
Yes.
And that in order to mask those symptoms, it requires an enormous amount of control, does it not?
It depends on the level and the extremism of the psychotic processing. So some people will hear voices that are nominal, they whisper. Some people hear voices that are yelling and screaming. So it's on a range, it's a continuum. So the more upsetting, more powerful, demanding the voice, the more difficult it might be to resist it and do other things. The less, the easier it is.
In all of the time between September of 2022 and January 23rd of 2023, at any point in which the defendant heard these voices about harming herself, she didn't act on them then, did she?
That's correct, yes. She did not act on those. She sought help instead.
Your Honor, I would move to admit the recording played as the next exhibit.
I'm sorry, this is the what?
The recording that was played. I move to enter it as the next exhibit, please.
That may be admitted. Thank you.
I have no further questions at this time.
Let's talk about confirmation.
Can I sit down, please?
Oh, hold on. Ms. Buckingham.
Thank you.
And a seat.
Confirmation bias. In the field of forensics, interface of science and the law, trial of cases, hiring experts, having people give an opinion that a jury is going to listen to. Confirmation bias means that the individual might want to help out the person that they're testifying for. Is that right?
It can be, yes.
So in other words, if you have a shooting case and you're a ballistics guy, and without the ballistics showing that the defendant's gun shot the victim, the government has no case, they may send an email to that witness and say, hey, I really need your help here. And that might influence them, right?
Yes.
Now, you got involved with this case, as you indicated, out of my request, obviously.
Yes.
Compassion.
Correct.
The fact you had a young lady that was literally in extreme condition, emotionally, physically, you went to speak with her, correct?
I did, yes.
Do you care for her?
I do.
And is that a violation of the canon of ethics for professionals like you, if you care for your patient?
Not at all. Within the ethical standards, it's also noted to do an appropriate and meaningful forensic evaluation. It's strongly suggested you develop empathy and rapport. And when you have those two psychological constructs, you get more information from the respondent. You do not cherry pick the information. You include warts and all in your report. That avoids confirmatory bias, and you avoid confirmatory bias by also not looking at conclusions that other examiners come up with when they render their opinions, and you do your evaluations independent of anyone else. You do it by yourself.
How many times did you see her?
At the time that my report was...
No, right about now.
60 times.
How many hours have you put in sitting with Lindsay, either in the hospital or...
More than that, roughly.
And you have all of that information that you have brought here today to testify to this jury. Is that correct?
Yes.
Are you confirmed bias? Are you not telling the truth just to help Lindsay out, or is this your opinion based upon your review of the records, your interview of her, whether or not you care for her or not?
Overrule.
I am telling the truth.
We can re-ask that question. That answer will be stricken.
So you can't tell someone you're telling the truth. Okay, that's up to the jury to decide. Your opinion is based upon all of the times that you met with Lindsay, right?
Yes.
All the documents that you've reviewed, all of this, the exhibits that you're aware of, right?
Yes, as well as collateral contacts.
And in the course of your treatment and evaluation of her, one of the things the DA asked you about is the request that we brought to the court for accommodations. Do you recall that question from her?
Yes.
And is it your understanding that the request that we had seeking help from the judge was that she not be chained to a van when she's brought into this courthouse?
Objection.
No.
For a 5-week trial?
Yes, from Tewksbury to Plymouth.
And her medical condition with her paralysis and all of the rest of the bodily functions that you lose, that's a concern, isn't that right?
Very much so, yes.
And we also had to have the help of nurses that would be available in the event that there was any type of emergency issue, correct? That
objection.
We had to ask of the court.
No, overruled.
Yes, they're here every day.
So, confirmation bias. Can you tell this jury, is your opinion based upon money? Maybe you like me. Maybe you want to help her. Or is that based to your best ability as a professional of many, many years?
Yes. Confirmation bias is coming up with a conclusion before you reach an opinion. It's, in Latin, a tabula rasa, a blank slate. You draw no conclusion. The conclusion finds you. And if you don't do that, you are at risk of having confirmation bias.
I'm going to ask you a hypothetical and see if the hypothetical fits within your understanding as an expert of confirmation bias. Let's say hypothetically that a young woman is involved in an incident such as this that results in the death of her three babies, and that young woman is paralyzed, and that young woman is in a hospital, that young woman is facing indictments for triple homicide, and the incident occurred on January 24th, 2023, and it's not until 2026 that the district attorney's office hires three doctors.
Objection. Yeah. Sustain.
Sidebar.
More live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lindsay Clancy is on the way. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.